Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
Justice Sonia Sotomayor has posed what may be the most weighty question before the Supreme Court this term. She vocalized what so many people were thinking this week as the court heard oral arguments and the challenge to Mississippi's law banning abortions after 15 weeks. Coming up on the United States of Anxiety, we'll try to answer the justice's question as we look back at the year in law and forward at the widely expected overturning of Roe v. Wade.
Can you name the Supreme Court justices?
Brett Kavanaugh.
The lady that replaced RGB, the obsessive Christian, what's her name?
Yeah. Oh, this is embarrassing.
It ain't happening.
Do you trust that the Supreme Court is fair?
I would say no. It's definitely been influenced by lobbyists and politicians, and it's not like a truly fair democracy. Especially with the abortion laws, it's definitely not representative of the majority of women who make up more than 50% of this country.
The United States government, the way it is now, can't do anything for black people, can't do anything for black women.
Has your opinion of the Supreme Court changed at all in the past year?
I was always rather annoyed with the Supreme Court, but I think after RGB died, it went from annoyance to like, I've given up on y'all. At some point, you just gotta realize like, old white men ain't gonna change the way that we changed, and so long as we don't change that it's old white men, we're not gonna change the way we live in under them.
Welcome to the show, I'm Kai Wright. The Supreme Court is an odd thing, you know? It sits at a distance from us and from democracy by design, right? We don't vote for the justices. And maybe as a consequence, they feel so distant. Most of their work seems technical, you know, abstract ideas about the Constitution. And yet, of course, their rulings touch our lives so intimately. This is particularly true on matters of public health and civil rights, both of which are before the current court in dramatic ways. So as we reach the end of the year and start taking stock of what we've seen in this first year of the Biden era, we also want to take stock of the current Supreme Court, what they've done so far, and how those rulings sit in historical context. I'm joined by two dynamic court watchers, Imani Gandhi and Jessica Mason Pico. Sorry, Jessica Mason Piclo. Ooh. I'm going to get it right, Jessica. Our co-hosts of the podcast, Boom Lawyered, from Rewire News Group. Jessica is a former litigator and law instructor before becoming the executive editor of Rewire. And Imani is Rewire's senior editor for law and policy and says she's a recovering lawyer. Imani and Jessica, thank you so much for joining us and for your patience with my trouble with a microphone and names.
Oh, thanks for having us, and no worries.
Obviously, we should start with this past week's oral arguments in Jackson v. Dobbs. This is the case challenging Mississippi's ban on abortions after 15 weeks. And Imani, I was following your Twitter discussion about it after the arguments ended, and you have been emphatic that having heard the oral arguments, that this case will unquestionably conclude in the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Why are you so clear on that?
Because it's not possible to uphold Mississippi's 15-week ban and uphold Roe at the same time. It's literally impossible. Mm. And if there's one thing that anybody listening to this takes away from that, it is this. If the Supreme Court upholds this ban, then it is necessarily overturning Roe versus Wade. And, you know, Jess will probably talk about this soon, but, you know, there's been a lot of gaslighting that's going on because I think What's difficult about doing this work and having done this work for a decade is that I've seen this end game coming for a really, really long time.
Yeah.
So I've been preparing myself for it. I truly believe that there are a lot of people in this country who didn't see this coming or who thought that it would somehow not be as bad as it is. And it's just as bad as you think it is. Yeah. It really is. And, you know, abortion has been basically illegal, nullified in Texas already for 94, 95 days. So it's really, really serious. And this Supreme Court is going to overturn Roe. Roe has been effectively unavailable, you know, as a legal principle. Abortion has been unavailable as a constitutional right, as a fundamental right for so many people for so long, and it's going to get worse.
You said you've seen this coming, this endgame coming for 10 years. What do you mean by that? What is it you've been seeing?
Well, you know, when the Tea Party explosion happened in 2011, that was the point at which, you know, Christian evangelical conservatives really began to ramp up power at that point. I mean, it was just a deluge of abortion laws, and it just wasn't adequately or accurately covered in the media. Honestly, that's why I got into this job, because I was looking at the landscape and I was seeing people like Jess and people like Robin Marty, and there were some people who were really in the core of this fight covering it from a journalist's angle. But there just wasn't enough discussion about how dire these bans were and how difficult these regulations of abortion providers were making it for people to access care. So I got into the game knowing and seeing the legislation year after year. I mean, this 15-week ban was a culmination of years and years of work. Mm-hmm. And we're talking organizations like Americans United for Life and ALEC, for example, that have been distributing essentially Mad Lib legislation throughout state legislatures across the country. So if you track these laws and if you track the court, it was easy to see this coming, particularly once Donald Trump installed himself in the White House and began installing judges on the bench.
Jessica Amani said that you might be able to tell us about the gaslighting. She says that it's been going on. What's she talking about there? What is the gaslighting that's been happening since the oral arguments this week?
Sure. So I think Amani's right on with everything that she said so far. And I think, you know, just to add a little bit more context to that, it's not just in the abortion rights context that we see this with the court. It is really, truly all of their big decisions that they know will be unpopular. And there's a way that they try to walk them back. Even we can go back as far as like Shelby County versus Holder, for example, which was the decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act. In that, the Supreme Court is saying, you know, in that decision, they say, well, look, you know, we're functionally a post-racial society. And so we don't need to have this remedy anymore. In oral arguments in Dobbs, we heard very much of the same kind of arguments from the conservative justices. You know, Amy Coney Barrett, for example, was very interested in the fact that all states have what's called a safe harbor law that allows somebody who has just delivered a baby to surrender that baby to the state without fear of prosecution for neglect and to have those parental rights terminated. To have that conversation and to have a suspension of parental rights, for example, be suggested as a substitute for abortion, and then to just say like, no, that's the conversation we're having, that's gaslighting. You're not having that conversation about the fact that you're really here undoing 50 years of precedent. And I just want to add a little more to what Amani said. You know, everything she said about this, seeing copycat bills in states across the country, is true. From 2010 on, we have seen states pass increasingly more restrictive bans. The only thing that hadn't changed was the federal courts. They had done a really great job of blocking all of these bills, even Mississippi's bill. And Mississippi petitioned to the Supreme Court when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was still alive. And a lot of us watching this case were like, oh, there goes Mississippi. They want this to go to the court. We'll see what happens. And the court thought about this case for 11 months and didn't do anything about it. And then Justice Ginsburg died and Amy Coney Barrett is nominated. And then the court takes the case. So when we talk about seeing signals from the conservatives, who have the votes, by the way, to overturn Roe versus Wade entirely, they don't have to do any measured ruling. They don't have to chip away at the sides here. They have 5-6 votes to reverse this law. Those are some of the clues that we're looking for.
I mean, one of the things that maybe along these lines that I found confusing, I guess, in listening to the oral arguments. There's all this conversation about the burden that this law in Mississippi would put on a woman who wanted to seek an abortion. And honestly, the whole thing felt very disingenuous. Like, the questions felt disingenuous. And even the responses from the solicitor and from the Center for Reproductive Rights also felt kind of weak sauce. Like, they weren't like no one seemed to actually be having a conversation about the burden of it. And help me understand what I was hearing. And maybe that's because I'm not a lawyer, right? And so there was some subtext here I didn't understand. But I thought, boy, obviously the burden is going to be totally personal, individual, by whoever shows up. This is an unanswerable question, whether or not there's a burden. So what is the point of that conversation?
So one of the reasons that we're having a conversation about burdens at all is because abortion is a fundamental constitutional right. And whenever a court, whether it's a district court or the Supreme Court, determines whether a government action, in this case, Mississippi trying to ban abortion at 15 weeks, is constitutional, it has to look at what is the sort of impact, what is the burden on that right? And so what are the rights here when we're talking about abortion? They're the right to privacy, their liberty interests, their rights to bodily autonomy. And so the conversation around the burden of that, as you said, did feel very disingenuous, but unfortunately, it's a constitutional necessity. And I think it felt very disingenuous in part because the Solicitor General Scott Stewart for the state of Mississippi was really just trying to hide the end game here. We even heard him say, look, justices, if you uphold the 15-week ban, we promise you it ends there. And we have no reason to believe him. Why? Mississippi has a 6-week ban that they're trying to enforce, for example. And also, the same legal principles that uphold the right to abortion, the right to bodily autonomy in Roe versus Wade, uphold your right to marriage equality, uphold your right to birth control. And we know in states like Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana, that there's legislation that conservative lawmakers are trying to pass right now to roll back those rights as well.
And so you're saying the point is that the outcome of this ruling could set a precedent for rolling back all of those civil rights laws as well.
100%. And if conservatives tell you no, don't believe them.
And part of the issue, if I may be so bold, with respect to why maybe you felt the arguments felt just disingenuous or weren't robust, is the manner that the case got to the Supreme Court, right? So Jessica talked about how Mississippi passed this law in 2018. You know, it was struck down by the district court. It was struck down by the Fifth Circuit. Then it gets up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sits on it for 11 months. And so Mississippi, when it asked the Supreme Court to hear this case, it asked a very specific question. It asked the court to consider whether or not its 15-week abortion ban was constitutional under current law. That means it asked the court, when it asked the court to take this case, it said, can you please tell us, Supreme Court, whether or not our ban is constitutional under current law, meaning Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The answer to that question is no. Like, it is absolutely no. So what happens is and this is where it gets really sort of devious and diabolical. Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies. Amy Coney Barrett ascends to the bench. And then Mississippi files its merits brief. After the court says, sure, we'll take a look at this question as to whether or not your ban is constitutional under current law, Mississippi changed the game. It changed the nature of its appeal. It said, you know what? We don't want you to answer that question anymore. Actually, we just want you to answer whether or not Roe and Casey should be upheld at all, whether or not there exists a right to abortion at all. And so when you change the nature of an appeal in the middle of the game, you're precluding the opposing party, right? You're precluding Jackson Women's Health from making a full argument as to why it is Roe versus Wade should be upheld, why it is Planned Parenthood versus Casey should be upheld, why abortion is so important to women and pregnant people, social science studies, you know, all of these issues that you would expect to arise when you're dealing with such a momentous question as should we overturn Roe versus Wade? And normally when Supreme Court litigants are asking the court to overturn precedent, they ask the court directly. They don't say, hey, can you analyze this law under your current regime? Wait for a liberal justice to die. Wait for a conservative justice to pump up the numbers and then change the nature of the question, knowing that this Supreme Court doesn't really care about institutional norms, civil procedure, the rule of law. It is a lawless court. It is a court that has gone rogue. And for a group of people, conservatives love to talk about how liberals are legislating from the bench. When the court does what we know that the court is going to do, it will be because it has legislated from the bench a case it shouldn't have.
I want to talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. But first, let's go to Dan in New Jersey, who I think has a basic question about the Jackson v. Dobbs case. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm a physician, and I'm a brain researcher. I do brain development research, and I can understand if someone is against abortion. I am against abortion, but I'm personally against abortion, meaning I wouldn't want my wife or the woman that I impregnate to abort. But that's my personal decision. And this does not seem to be based on the idea that abortion is bad. This seems to be based on the idea of a 15-week viability issue. And I don't know what they mean by viability, because if they were to discuss the medical viability of the fetus at that point, there's no such thing. I mean, it would be a horrendous existence for that child. So I think you guys in the law are sort of leaving the planet, and the rest of us is stuck here with your extraterrestrial judgments. You are not real when you discuss this stuff.
Thank you, Dan. So I think Dan's getting a little bit at what I was getting out of, like, it just does, it feels very unreal, this conversation. But what about this question of viability is a core debate? So explain what he's talking about there quickly and then try to answer it for him.
Sure. This goes to Imani's point that she made right at the top of the show, which is that there's no way for the Supreme Court to uphold Mississippi's law without overturning Roe versus Wade. And that's because one of the key principles that Roe and Casey stand for is that a state can't ban abortion before fetal viability. And under the law, that means a meaningful existence outside of the womb. And typically that has landed around 24 weeks medically indicated. Although the case law also says that viability is an individual standard as well, to be determined between the person having the pregnancy and their physician, which is why Roe and Casey say states can't ban abortion before viability. So we are in the land of circular logic here with Dobbs.
I'm talking with Jessica Mason Piclo and Imani Gandhi, co-hosts of the podcast Boom Lawyered from Rewire News Group. After a break, we're going to look back at the year in the Supreme Court with cases beyond just Dobbs and Jackson. And we'll take more of your calls. Jessica and Imani follow the court through civil rights and public health cases. So if you've got a question about either, call us up. We'll take more of your calls after a break.
Hey everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. Here's a listener voicemail we got in response to our episode about the history of secession and disunity in the United States. If you have a response to this episode or anything else, record yourself and email us. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks. Here's the message.
Hello, my name is Juan. I wanted to highlight like another kind of sentiment of separation from the United States that occurs in South Florida. I think that Miami itself has even created a homogenous culture between all the Hispanic cultures that exist there. It's not just a purely Cuban, Colombian, Venezuelan, Argentinian, Brazilian, a mixing bowl of it that creates Miami culture, right? A standing point for people to go off and say, you know what, yes, Miami is a very separate place. It's a very unique thing in the United States. It might not politically be a secession movement, but I'm wondering if this has occurred in Los Angeles or any other multi-ethnic city where a homogenous group kind of starts to form its own culture and then starts to kind of create this idea of separation. And I wonder at what point, if there is any, there's a secession occurring. Thank you.
Number 91744, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Robert P. Casey.
Your argument this morning in case 19-1392, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Whether our Constitution endows government with the power to force a woman to continue or to end a pregnancy against her will is the central question in this case.
Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and we are considering the question you just heard Justice Sonia Sotomayor pose during this past week's oral argument over Mississippi's ban on legal access to abortion after 15 weeks. I'm joined by Jessica Mason Piclo and Imani Gandhi, who are co-hosts of the Boom Lawyered podcast from Rewire News Group. And let's go to Mabel in Trenton, New Jersey. Mabel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for accepting my call. I wanted to tell you, the last time that I went to a gynecologist, she asked on the application whether or not I'd ever had an abortion. I didn't feel comfortable answering that question because of some of the talk that I'd heard before. So I told her I don't want to answer that question. And she just sort of nodded and I guess checked it off. I don't know. But what I wanted to say about the court, no, I don't trust them because I believe that these conservative justices who have been supported all of their lives by people whose religion believe that women should be subservient to men and should not have autonomy through their own body want to please these people for the sake of their own careers. And it is very scary because I wonder a party who seems to be against welfare or, you know, giving children lunches at school, why are they so concerned about the unborn children that women who don't have the means to care for these children should have to bring into this world that they can't afford? And they have to make an emotional decision as to whether they want to bring a child in that they know they can't afford.
Let me ask you, Mabel, has your opinion changed? You said you don't trust them. You're being very clear about that. Is that different for you than it's been in the past?
No, of course it has not changed. I fear that women are going to be treated as second-class citizens and we are going to lose our autonomy and the right to choose how to live our lives or whether or not we are ready to bring another person into a world that does not care about people, about its citizens.
Thank you for calling, Mabel. Let's go to Joe in Sunnyside, Staten Island. Joe, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Kai. Thank you for having me. I feel as though I'm going to be parroting what your guests from Boom Lawyered have said, but it's more than just gaslighting. It's also sort of 1984 doublespeak when you have, you know, conservatives saying that they don't want liberal justices legislating from the bench when they have slotted in a whole bunch of people who are going to legislate based on ideology and not on rule of law. And as far as whether I, you know, have always felt this way, no, I haven't. I mean, we've watched over the last, you know, couple of decades as they've moved people in who are definitely, you know, based on ideology, you know, not whether it's conservative or religious or, you know, anything else. They are against, you know, they're away from the rule of law. And if you look at Roe in the first place, I mean, it wasn't about religion. It was about privacy. It was about a woman's and a U.S. citizen's right to privacy. Mm. And now we're going down this ideological path that is taking not just this decision, but all other decisions. And in a weird sort of, as I said, doublespeak.
Joe,
and
I'm going to leave it there, Joe.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you for that call. The doublespeak question, Jessica, you have studied the movement that led to a shift in who was being appointed to the Supreme Court. And how much has this doublespeak thing been part of that movement? And when you were nodding along as Joe was talking, is that something that you followed?
Yeah, I mean, we would not be in the position where the Supreme Court was considering reversing nearly 50 years of civil rights precedent in Roe versus Wade if it was not for a heavy assist from Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans, for example. So this has been a 20-year campaign in the making to reshape the federal judiciary, not just to undo Roe versus Wade, but basically all of the New Deal. what civil rights do you care about? Conservatives are coming for them, and they're doing so via Federalist Society judges. So the Federalist Society, you will hear folks talk about, they're an organization that exists on law student campuses across the country. And, you know, they promote conservative legal principles. But then recently, they've sort of gone on steroids and have now taken the most extreme positions of the conservative legal movement and taken them mainstream. Things like, you know, a complete and unfettered Second Amendment right, which the Supreme Court took up this term as well. You know, we're talking about abortion, but there's a huge gun rights case out of New York, for example, conservatives on that. So, you know, we got to the place where the Supreme Court decided to take a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade when there's no conflict in federal law. And they did so because those judges were put on the bench for this purpose. So this is absolutely a campaign.
Let's hear from Claire in Hartsdale, New York. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Well, I just wanted to say one thing is that my late husband, who was very into reproductive rights, he first realized when he was a resident in OBGYN in Boston that women were coming in and dying from having had botched abortions. And I fear that it's going to go back that same direction if this is not upheld. He used to testify before Congress as well of why it was important and go to the Women's March. Maybe we need more women's marches again. But secondly, I don't understand why these people care so much about unborn children when they don't care about children being shot at schools, they don't care about gun laws, and they don't care about people going to war and killing other people. So it's very, very crazy. And thirdly, women should have the right over their own bodies. That's the main thing. They should really have the choice over their own bodies, what they do. Has nothing to do with men deciding that.
Thank you for calling, Clara. So there are two things in there I want to follow up on with you guys. So, Imani, this question of whether or not they care about guns as well, as they said, as we talked about, there is a gun case there in this term as well. Have you been following that gun case? And if so, what can you tell us about where it's going?
I mean, the gun case out of New York is actually rather frightening, given the rhetoric that the justices were dabbling in. It seems that they are about to require states to allow any, quote, ordinary citizen to get a gun simply by filling out a form. They are removing any sense of discretion, any sort of subjective criteria regarding who gets to own guns and who and where you get to own guns. And, you know, following this case a little bit, I see a lot of people making the same comment, which is, okay, if you're going to say that any New Yorker can have a gun pretty much wherever they want, then why doesn't the Supreme Court open up its doors and allow people to parade guns through its doors, yes, right? I mean, I have similar questions when it comes to abortion rights and buffer zones. Why is it that abortion clinics can't get a few feet around the building in order to allow patients to get through the doors without being harassed by quote unquote sidewalk counselors who are generally actually violent domestic terrorists? Why is it okay for the Supreme Court to get a buffer zone and to protect itself and the justices who sit in that building, but not okay for abortion clinics or not okay for regular New Yorkers who don't want to walk into a church or a school or a college campus and have to worry about there being guns? New York is such an overpopulated place. The idea that you are going to New York City, that is, right? Manhattan, yeah. I'm talking about. The idea that you're going to allow anyone to own guns, to have a gun in public, to have a concealed weapon is absolutely just shocking to me. It really is.
And have we seen, on the other thing I want to follow up from Claire, is have we seen, you know, as you pointed out earlier, Imani, there are many states that already have functional bans on abortion. So have we already seen what the consequences of that would be? Are there things that we already know are going to be true if, in fact, as you predict, Roe is going to be overturned next summer? Do we already know what that looks like?
Sure, we can take a look at what's going on in Texas right now to figure out what it's going to look like in nationally once the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade. Pregnant people in Texas are now going to Colorado. They're going to these regional points of access to get care, which is then making those clinics unable to serve the local population that they generally serve. So this has been a, you know, people want to talk about whether or not upholding the Mississippi ban is going to be some sort of compromise, or whether or not people who support abortion rights are really going too far in our call for complete bodily autonomy. But the bottom line is that overturning Roe versus Wade is very unpopular. If you ask specific questions of people related to abortion, not just generally, do you believe life begins at conception, or do you, quote, believe in abortion as if abortion is some sort of fantasy that one can believe in or not believe in? If you ask targeted questions like, do you know that most people don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks? Do you know that this Texas ban means that most people and pregnant people in Texas cannot access abortion? And if you begin to look at the ways in which these struggles have been ongoing for literally a decade, you're going to see, you see a little bit, a modicum of what it's going to look like once abortion has been either completely criminalized or just thrown back to the states. And we have this patchwork system where someone has to travel 3-4 states over just to get basic medical care.
Let's go to Bill in Crown Heights. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am an attorney's son. I'm 54 now, but I grew up, you know, talking a lot about the courts and how you never knew how an appointed justice was going to vote later on in their career. And I also grew up believing that the law, what the law says and what is right, were not always the same. The court's jobs were to uphold the law, from my personal point of view, something may be illegal, and I may believe it should be legal, but, you know, it's still illegal. You change it legislatively. Now we really are seeing legislation from the bench. We saw it with the Voting Rights Act. We saw it when the Second Amendment was reinterpreted to, you know, be an individual right to carry a firearm. So it just seems like there, and the concept of originalism, of saying we're going to, you know, analyze the text to the exact way the founding fathers meant to it. When we're in a world with computers and skyscrapers and airplanes, in itself, it doesn't make sense. So I don't know how to see this as anything other than political.
Thanks for your call, Bill. Jessica, on this question of a political court, right? So it is not like it's new that a Supreme Court has an ideological bent, or it seems to me like that's not new, that the Supreme Court has always kind of had politics in it. What is different then about this court? Why, to your mind, how is this distinct from previous political courts?
That's such an excellent point, because the court has, you're absolutely right, always been political. I think one of the things that really changed the game here, though, was when Senate Republicans blocked the Merrick Garland nomination and really just amplified this fight. Because to the caller's point and to what you've said, we've always talked about justices' political views in the nomination process. And we've, you know, long before even the Garland nomination, talked about how even the Senate confirmation process felt kind of thin in really getting to sort of some nuts and bolts. But in large part, that's because up until the Garland nomination, there was an understanding that, you know, the party in power got to have their judicial appointments. And you may not like it, but that's why you have elections. And that was just part of it. But Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans really broke the last of the norms in the Garland nomination. And they were inching, they were towing up to that line. They had started messing around with other procedural things to block Obama nominees early on. But that really changed the game. And we know it's changed the game, because we hear Mitch McConnell now already talking about what would happen if, for example, Justice Stephen Breyer were to retire before the 2024 presidential election. As far as Mitch McConnell is concerned, he's holding that seat open. So this is not about the justices necessarily being political actors entirely themselves. This is also about the Republicans in particular treating the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary as a political football and trophy where they get all of the spoils of victory.
So that the distinction here is partisanship as opposed to conservative ideology.
Truly.
Or liberal ideology.
Truly. I mean, if you look at the way, for example, Justice Sam Alito behaves on the bench, that's not political, that's partisan. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a ideological framework that you could then provide for this current court in historical context? I mean, so are you saying, no, you can't. You just have to throw that out. This is just about partisanship.
I do think it's just about partisanship. I think Chief Justice John Roberts really wants it to be not about partisanship, but that ship has sailed. And we need to talk about the fact that that ship has sailed, because there is no way to fix the court unless we do. We cannot talk about the fact that any progressive policy measure that Democrats and the Biden administration hope to pass is dead on arrival with the Supreme Court. And it's not just them, it's the lower courts now too. I mean, the Trump administration successfully appointed 1 in 4 federal courts of appeals judges. That changes the game. That doesn't just block rulings, that changes the law. Those opinions shape the way that the other courts below think and analyze issues that come before them. So this is really a slow-moving, radical shift to the right.
So am I right in assuming that either of you would, well, let me ask the question rather, where do you guys come down on this idea of expanding the court?
I mean, I think we need to expand the court. As Jess said, any progressive measure that reaches the Supreme Court is absolutely dead on arrival. And I think what's a shame about that is that we are able to predict that now. That's what makes this court so partisan. It used to be, you know, we don't have any David Souters, for example, who's going to write some side memo and rescue the right to abortion. We don't. The conservatives learned their lesson from David Souter, and they were never again going to appoint a justice to the Supreme Court without knowing in advance how they are going to rule, which is why you get these shows, these circuses at these confirmation hearings where these nominees have to sit in a Senate confirmation hearing and pretend that they believe in Roe versus Wade as precedent. I mean, that's what Brett Kavanaugh did. You know, he was downright offended when asked whether or not he believed Roe versus Wade was still good precedent. And then he's asking questions, you know, during oral arguments last Wednesday in the Dobbs case that make it obvious that he doesn't view abortion as a fundamental right, that makes it clear that he's almost annoyed that he has to even hear the question. And so, and I think you could say the same thing about John Roberts, right? I mean, if you think back to his confirmation hearing, he's the guy who was talking about, he's just calling balls and strikes. There's no calling balls and strikes when you're sitting in the Dobbs oral arguments and asking questions about whether or not the viability line is even the holding of Roe versus Wade. This is not good faith that we're dealing with here.
Let me ask you this though, Imani, with, you know, just we got about a minute and a half left here. Given everything that you've just said, how do you think about the fact that the Supreme Court isn't and never was a place to pursue the kind of social change that you want to see, that it never was going to be a place that is going to be a place for racial justice, and that we should be looking elsewhere for racial justice? I mean,
I don't think it's the case that we don't see social change coming out of the Supreme Court. I think Brown versus Board of Education is a clear example of that. What I think is the problem is that we are dealing with justices who favor some rights and disfavor some rights. So the fact that I favor abortion as a constitutional right, as a human right, I don't think should be couched as me advocating for some sort of social change. It's advocating for what fundamentally puts us on this earth, which is whether or not we have a say on what we do with our bodies, whether or not the liberty that this country was supposedly founded on extends to women and pregnant people. So I certainly don't think that we can look to the court for grand social change, but certainly the court has a very, very strong role to play when it comes to shaping law and social change.
We'll have to leave it there. Imani Gandhi and Jessica Mason Piklow are co-hosts of the Boom Lawyered podcast from Rewire News Group. Thanks to both of you for joining us. And thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry to those we couldn't take. You can still talk to us. We'd love to hear your thoughts by email. Just record a voice memo on your phone and email it to anxiety@wnyc.org. Before Thanksgiving, we gave you some homework testing out your own so-called filter bubbles online. Coming up, we'll see what you learned. And I want to know, who's this Topher guy and why is he all up in my YouTube searches? That's next.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll hear argument this morning in case 2843, case New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
The Supreme Court is supposed to be a place where our heated disputes and competing interests get resolved among cooler heads, considering the facts of the law. As I mentioned earlier in the show, I don't know that I ever believed that idea, but it seems clear that a lot of people who did believe it have changed their minds, because even at the bench of the highest court in the land, facts themselves are elusive, never mind truth and justice. We seem to be living in alternate realities, an experience that many people blame on the internet and the way it can distort reality, particularly when it comes to politics and hard conversations about stuff like race and gender and the effort to live in this country together. So we began a new beat on this show just before Thanksgiving. We're frankly just looking for a happier, healthier kind of political engagement in our own digital lives. So we are inviting you all along. We began by giving you an assignment to just build some basic literacy about it all. And we are now going to follow up on that homework. I'm joined by our senior digital producer, Kusha Navidar, who's going to bring us up to speed. Kusha, hey.
Hey, Kai. Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, we asked our listeners to do an experiment to see if we could get a peek into how the content we get online is filtered and personalized. Here's what happened. We asked listeners to go onto YouTube with their family and search for the word patriot. Now, this wasn't necessarily to prove anything about search results. We talked about that, Kai, right? It was just to see if it could spark any interesting comparisons and conversations.
Right, because, of course, it was Thanksgiving, and, you know, this might be a way to sort of interrupt the Thanksgiving fight was to, hey, let's look on the internet and see what kind of bubble we're in. Okay, so what happened?
Right, so we got a lot of responses back and a couple of interesting conversations. So thanks to everyone who participated. Overwhelmingly, people across this country actually decided to send us just screenshots of their search results, which was great, too. So, you know, we wanted to lean into that. We thought it'd be cool to actually share what those search results were. But, you know, we're on the radio. You can't get screenshots on the radio, at least not yet. I don't know. Right. Metaverse, maybe something that happened there. But anyway, I went around WNYC studios and asked people to read off the results we received in order, and we stitched them together. And I think there's some interesting stuff when you listen to everyone's results kind of mixed in. So take a listen. Here are your search results to YouTubing the word patriot.
Did the YouTube patriot search and got
1. The Patriot.
A Mel Gibson movie.
Patriot movie.
The Patriot.
Steven Seagal.
Patriots versus Falcons, Week 11 highlights.
Patriots versus Falcons, Week 11.
Topher, The Patriot, featuring At Marine Rapper.
2. Topher, The Patriot, featuring At the Marine Rapper.
Topher, The Patriot.
Topher, The Patriot.
Trooper, The Patriot.
A whole bunch of SNL clips.
Patriots versus Falcons.
Australia's new Ram 1500.
3.
The Patriot 2000.
Patriot 2000.
2 Fox contributors resign after Tucker Carlson special.
Hasan Minhaj segment about American obesity.
This is a patriot and a veteran.
4. Mike Pence stabs MAGA in the back again. Shocking info on Waukesha suspect.
Trump outsmarts TDS Libs again. Whoa, guess what?
Trump outsmarts TDS Libs again. Whoa, guess what?
Trevor Noah. Trump asks Pence if he's a patriot or a
Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj. Why billionaires won't save us.
Exciting new 2022 Ford Patriot AWD.
Trump outsmarts TDS Libs again. Whoa, guess what?
And a CNN clip about Fox News contributors resigning because of Tucker Carlson.
This is what searching for yoga videos, snowboard reviews, surf instruction videos, and Mercedes repair videos gets you.
So honestly, Kusha, what struck me in this was how many of us got similar content in our YouTube searchers and how we all got some fairly far-right political stuff regardless of our own politics.
Yeah, and just as a reminder, the goal here wasn't to try and prove that the filter bubble exists or it doesn't. It was more about looking thoughtfully at similarities and differences. Mm-hmm. And a lot of listeners who identified as either progressive or apolitical said to us they were surprised about the conservative content in their feeds. One listener, David, told us he tried this with 4 different family members and they were surprised
that they each got different political videos that didn't align with their own beliefs.
Mm. Okay, so what about this Topher guy? I had assumed I was being fed him because he's a hip-hop artist or because he's black and he has this, you know, pointed political message. But now I'm hearing that everyone's getting him. And again, he's got that very specific right-wing political message. So should I take something from that?
Actually, Kai, what you shouldn't take from it is that it's about his politics, at least not explicitly, which makes Topher's music video a case study at how something gets to the top of our feeds. So let's focus on him for a minute, okay? Mm-hmm. I went to someone who's familiar with Topher and how this content lives online. Will Sommer is a reporter who covers conservative media for The Daily Beast. He's got a book coming out next year on QAnon, and he follows the ideological trends on the right, particularly the internet. So I asked him, who is Topher?
Topher is this rapper who's originally from Mississippi. He has a background in the military. He was in the Air Force, which obviously is to his credit in the and sort of establishes his bona fides as this, you know, this real big American patriot on the right. I had heard of Topher as one of this sort of universe of what you might call like MAGA rappers. In his marketing, there's a lot of red, you know, which is obviously a Trump color. Also, of course, for the patriotic color. Topher has a vibrant TikTok presence. His own cryptocurrency. His most recent one is this Brandon coin, which is a play off of Let's Go Brandon, this conservative motto.
I don't know that motto, but his own cryptocurrency.
Yeah, he sounds like he's really well-versed at operating within these internet trends.
But, I mean, he also sounds quite niche. Again, you know, I mean, so how does someone like that make a video that beats out hugely popular things that I think would be able to overcome him?
Yeah, well, it reveals a little bit about all the factors beyond politics that determine any given result. Here's Will telling us the story of this music video.
So in December 2020, Topher releases this song called Patriot. And this is, you know, we have to think back to that time. I mean, this was a period where Trump supporters were really mad about the election. They were convinced it was stolen. And so Topher's song is, I think, channeling that anger and saying, you know, we're going to take the country back. Enough with tyranny, we come to take our country back. For all citizens, white, red, brown, or black. The chorus is like this crazy, like, Viking song, essentially, about hewing foemen, or, you know, essentially cutting your enemies in half. So this song comes out in December, and it gains some popularity on the right. Then on January 6th, Topher is in Washington performing at a concert, not around the Capitol, but, you know, at the same time, and he's performing this song as the riot is unfolding. After the riot, there was a big crackdown from social media companies on a lot of Trump content, and particularly content that was seen as violent. And so Topher, he claims, gets his music banned from YouTube and Spotify. You know, a lot of times these allegations of censorship can be a little more muddied. We're sort of taking Topher at his word here. Sometimes it's, you know, sort of a random technical error, or, you know, there's something else going on here. But I think what matters is Topher's claim about it, which is that he was this victim of censorship. And we know, you know, among Trump supporters, being a victim of censorship sort of turns you into, or claiming to be, turns you into a sort of martyr figure. And they say, you know, that increases a lot of attention on you. And I think it makes people more likely to share your content or listen to your music in Topher's case, because suddenly it has this allure of the forbidden and this idea that, you know, this is the song Google or Spotify doesn't want you to hear. I mean, this is the song that's really telling the truth about what's going on.
So Kai, it's a political song, but in the sense of getting to the top of a search result, it has a lot of things going for it that are actually apolitical. Will had a really good analogy using Lady Gaga.
In the case of the YouTube algorithm, there's a lot we don't know. I mean, it's sort of a black box. But I think we can imagine a couple things. Number one, I think because of this tale of censorship, and we can see that Topher's story about this was picked up by a lot of right-wing blogs. And so this story spread that, like, this was the forbidden song. And so I think from there, people wanted to check it out. So we know that if a video is getting watched more, it's going to be pushed up. YouTube is going to be more likely to favor it in the search results. I think also it helps that it's a song. So we know that probably people are playing it all the way through. So in YouTube, it's in the algorithm, that's going to say, okay, people are liking this video. They aren't clicking off of it after 10 seconds. So we will again favor it higher. And, you know, it just being named Patriot, I think obviously it's going to return for the search result Patriot. So I think if you think about other songs, for example, like Lady Gaga's Poker Face, let's say. Can't read my, can't read my. you search poker face on YouTube, the results can be Lady Gaga. Maybe a video, a how-to video about how to maintain your poker face during a poker game is going to be lower. And so, I mean, because it's a song and because it has, like, I wouldn't say a broad appeal, but certainly I think probably a broader appeal than most Patriot videos, besides maybe the trailer for the movie Patriot. It's getting, like, you can see, I mean, it has 3-4 million views on one version of it. It has nearly 2 million on another. I mean, these are big numbers in terms of YouTube. So I think it's only natural that the algorithm would be returning it that highly.
So what do we take from this, Kusha? People who did this experiment said they got all this political content they didn't agree with or that they didn't expect. Good or a bad thing?
Well, Will used a phrase that I liked a lot called value neutral. In the case of Topher, agree or disagree, he's using strategies that any content creator would use. So this doesn't let YouTube or Facebook or wherever off the hook, but it does ask what happens on that next video you're going to watch. It's a first step into that journey of deciding what to click on.
Right. And it also brings up another question, right? Like, if people like me or some of our listeners who were apolitical or progressive got this Topher video, are people making far right content better at making sure we see their video?
That's a great question. And honestly, I don't know. And I'd like to find that out too. So maybe we could do our next segment on it.
We will look out for it. Thank you, Kusha.
Yeah, you bet.
And thanks to everybody who did this experiment with us. We love how game you all were, so we'll be doing more of this with you. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound designed by Jarrett Paul. Kevin Bristow and Milton Ruiz were at the boards for the live show. Archival Supreme Court audio this week came from Oye. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Froman, and Kusha Navidar. And I, of course, am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright or shoot me an email at anxiety@wnyc.org. And as always, I hope that you will join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at wnyc.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.